The headlines: Lebanon forms a new government after being run by a caretaker government for over a year. Israel arrests more relatives of several Palestinians who've recently managed to escape a high-security Israeli prison. And Russian energy giant Gazprom says it has finished construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas subsea pipeline to Germany. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Lebanon has announced the formation of a new government under Najib Mirati in an attempt to put an end to the country's months-long political deadlock. Lebanon's President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mirati officially signed the decree to form the new government on Friday. The presidency said in a statement that the decree was signed in the presence of Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri. The new cabinet consists of 24 members. Walid Fayyad has been designated energy and water minister, while Maurice Selim will take the helm of the defense ministry. Mirati was tasked with forming a new government in July. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration led by Hassan Diab since last August. The country is grappling with a deep financial crisis worsened by a political deadlock. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, has joined us earlier with the latest on the formation of the new government in Lebanon.
What we're seeing here from Prime Minister Najib Mirati is probably a very positive step forward. This is going to assist Lebanon in itself, because just at the very moment when this cabinet was declared, we saw the price of the dollar very quickly decreasing. Though, so that in itself was a positive sign for Lebanon. However, we do have a myriad of challenges that lie ahead for Lebanon. The socioeconomic crisis still continues. The fuel crisis is still continuing as well. And even the price of the dollar itself is still too high for people. You have the issue of subsidies, which has almost completely ended. The cabinet has lifted its hand off the issues of subsidies. So you have many issues, challenges for Prime Minister and Mirati and his team. We know that on Monday, the cabinet will meet for its first meeting in order to discuss its manifesto, which is usually a very significant issue. Of course, it highlights the general policy of the cabinet usually, after which, of course, they will give this manifesto to the parliament to study it and in order to acquire the confidence of the parliament.
The Israeli army has made more arrests over the Monday jailbreak of six Palestinians from a high-security prison of the regime. Two brothers and a sister of suspected mastermind Mahmoud Arda were detained near the city of Jenin in the northern West Bank. Other relatives of the six fugitives, all from the Jenin area, were arrested on Wednesday. They are now all in detention. A massive manhunt is also underway in the occupied territories. The six Palestinians escaped from Gilboa prison through a tunnel dug beneath a sink in a cell. Israel has decided to relocate inmates following the jailbreak. Palestinians have taken to the streets across the occupied territories to voice their anger at aggression against Palestinians languishing in Israeli jails. Palestinians in Al-Quds gathered at Al-Aqsa Mosque chanting slogans in solidarity with the prisoners and condemning the regime's repression inside prisons. Similar protests were also held in the town of Araba near Jenin. People in the besieged Gaza Strip also offered Friday prayers in front of the Red Cross headquarters to express their support of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Palestinian resistance factions had called for a day of rage on Friday against Israel's decision to relocate inmates. Israeli regime is using heavy-handed tactics against inmates and their families since six Palestinians escaped from the regime's high-security prison. Residents of Dar al-Balad in southwestern Syria have returned to their homes after a deal which led to the Syrian army's taking control of the neighborhood from the armed groups. Our correspondent, Muhammad Ali, has visited the area and filed this report for us.
For the first time in 10 years, the Syrian army has entered Dar al-Balad in Daraa city. This is an implementation of a long negotiated deal with armed men that collapsed many times because of their violations. 9 checkpoints for the Syrian army have been established to ensure security after 900 armed men reconciled and surrendered their arms. Russian military police is also there, patrolling and supervising the deal's implementation. The Syrian flag was also raised on Al-Manshiya Police Department inside, signaling the return of law and order to the area.
Today, Dar al-Balad returns to Syria with efforts of people and security forces. Reconciliation talks have been successful. The armed forces and police have entered the town and 9 security checkpoints have been established.
The government's control over Dar al-Balad will lead to the reopening of public institutions and providing basic services to the residents, as well as reconstruction.
As you can see, security and stability have been restored. The town has a strategic location along Syria's border with Jordan. The restoration of public services is highly important for the residents of Dar al-Balad.
Meanwhile, Al-Mukhayyam Quarter remains under the control of armed groups who refuse any peaceful deal with the government, similar to some villages west of Dar'a. Thousands of people who left the town before a peaceful deal were allowed to return to their homes, marking the end of yet another chapter of an armed conflict in Syria. The military regaining control of Dar'a al-Balad is a testament to what Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said time and again, that the army is determined to retake every inch of Syrian territory. After 10 years of war, the government continues to prioritize peaceful solutions to end any conflict like the one here in Dar al-Balad. Hamad Ali, Dar al-Balad, southern Syria.
Concerns are mounting over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan as funds remain frozen in the wake of the Taliban takeover of the country. The UN has warned of an economic collapse there. It says the world has a duty to extend solidarity to Afghanistan, where millions risk dying of hunger.
Fears are growing over the humanitarian situation in Afghanistan, where a new government is being formed under the Taliban rule, a group not yet recognized by the international community. The UN chief has called for maintaining a dialogue with the Taliban to avoid an economic collapse he says could lead to millions of deaths.
Naturally, the Taliban want to be recognized. They want the sanctions to be lifted. They want financial support, and this gives the international community some leverage. I think that naturally we don't have an internationally recognized government yet, but I also think that we have to avoid an economic collapse situation which could create appalling humanitarian consequences for the Afghan people.
The UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has also warned of humanitarian impacts if funds remain frozen in the aftermath of the Taliban takeover of the country.
Assets and dollar and donor funds have been frozen by members of the international community. The understandable purpose is to deny these funds to the de facto Taliban administration. The inevitable effect, however, will be a severe economic downturn that could throw many more millions into poverty and hunger, may generate a massive wave of refugees from Afghanistan, and indeed set Afghanistan back for generations.
Afghanistan's neighbors are also worried about the humanitarian situation there. Iran's permanent representative to the UN says Afghanistan's dire situation is a direct result of the 20-year U.S. war there.
Hundreds of thousands of Afghans have fled their country. Nearly 600,000 of others have become internally displaced. Essential food supplies are running short, and 18.4 million people need humanitarian assistance. This situation is primarily the direct result of the intervention by the United States and other foreign forces in Afghanistan and their irresponsible withdrawal.
The U.S. fully withdrew from Afghanistan by August 31st, 2 weeks after the Taliban swept to power. The pullout ended the U.S. military presence, criticized for failing to restore peace in Afghanistan. Washington is now facing calls by humanitarian groups to unfreeze funds parked in the U.S. as part of sanctions against the Taliban. Food and fuel prices are already soaring in Afghanistan amid a shortage of cash, partly triggered by the U.S. halt in dollar shipments. Aid groups say the cost of economically pressuring the new Afghan rulers is the lives of millions of ordinary people already bearing the brunt of 20 years of U.S. occupation.
Another anniversary of 9/11 terrorist attacks in the United States is approaching. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in response back in 2001, but two decades later, Americans are seeking accountability from another country.
The United States is preparing to mark the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terrorist attacks. The world will probably never forget that fateful day in 2001, which changed the course of history. U.S. investigators said the Al-Qaeda terror group was behind the whole thing. America said it had evidence showing that the attacks were planned and led from inside Afghanistan. This triggered the invasion of Afghanistan that bogged down the U.S. military for 20 years. Two decades later, the family members of 9/11 victims are still struggling to find answers. They have long been pursuing accountability from another country, Saudi Arabia. Most of the hijackers who carried out the attacks were Saudi nationals. That is not all that ties the kingdom to the complicated plot. Long classified documents have revealed that some of the hijackers had been in contact and received support from individuals connected to the Saudi government. They also show that the phone number of then Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan, was in the phone book of a close associate of Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden. The families of victims said in a statement last month that evidence implicates Saudi government officials in supporting the attacks. The families have long argued that Saudis had advanced knowledge of the plot, but did nothing to stop it. The families of the victims have been pushing for the release of more 9/11 documents that successive U.S. administrations have kept secret.
Under pressure from 9/11 victim families, U.S. President Joe Biden recently signed an executive order for a declassification review of files related to the FBI's investigation. The move comes after victim families called on Biden to refrain from going to Ground Zero in New York City on the 20th anniversary unless he releases all related documents.
Biden has made up his mind about the upcoming anniversary. He will visit all three sites where hijacked planes crashed 20 years ago to commemorate the victims. But will his administration give the victim families what they've been demanding so long? They want to know for certain if Saudi Arabia aided the hijackers. Some of the still-secret files relate to an FBI investigation known as Operation Encore that focused on the two hijackers who lived in San Diego and individuals who may have assisted them. A former FBI agent who was involved in the investigation has said that he is confident that the two hijackers had a U.S.-based support network. Riyadh still denies any involvement in the 9/11 plot. It is now fighting a lawsuit brought by the families in federal court in New York. Why have successive U.S. governments been reluctant to release the files so many years after the horrific event?
It has been a mystery why the U.S. has been covering up for connections to Saudi Arabia throughout these last 20 years. So that's why the 9/11 families have had their lawsuit and tried through the courts to get access to this information. But, you know, it's not just the 9/11 families. The entire public of the United States deserves to know what happened on 9/11 and before 9/11, deserves to know what connections the U.S. has been covering up for.
U.S. authorities have argued that any release of more files could result in damage to the national security. But some observers believe Saudi lobbies in America could have played a role in blocking the very long-awaited release. Top U.S. officials also seem reluctant to sour lucrative ties between America and the autocratic kingdom by thoroughly investigating the clues about possible Saudi government involvement in 9/11 events.
The close relationship that the U.S. government has with Saudi Arabia has made it very difficult for the 9/11 families to get the access to the information they deserve and they need to prosecute the case that has been going on for 20 years. against the 9/11 hijackers.
Will the Biden administration, which has promised more transparency, act differently?
Moving on, Russian energy giant Gazprom says it's finished construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas subsea pipeline to Germany. The Russian company began the project 5 years ago, but the progress was halted in 2019 when former U.S. President Donald Trump imposed sanctions against the project. Parts of the measures targeted vessels involved in the project. Russia resumed the construction of the pipeline earlier this year with the engagement of its own vessels. Nord Stream 2 will double Russia's gas exporting capacity to Europe via the Baltic Sea. It will also allow Moscow to bypass Ukraine. Following Gazprom's announcement, Kiev said it will fight the project. And official data shows that Britain's economic recovery slowed sharply in July despite further lifting of coronavirus restrictions. Britain's Office for National Statistics said gross domestic product output grew by only 0.1%. In July, it marked the sixth straight month of economic growth. However, the increase was much lower compared to the 1% growth in June. The recovery stalled amid rising COVID cases and worker shortages. On Wednesday, Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced a tax rise on workers and employers to fix a health and social care funding crisis. Following the announcement, a poll showed that public support for the ruling Conservative Party slipped by 5 points to 33%. That's the party's biggest slump since 2019. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of New World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. That's visibly not the case when it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security, from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work, to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons, to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written jointly by Mandy Smith Berger and William Harting, authors. This article is published under the heading U.S. Nearly $1.3 trillion National Security Budget Isn't Making Americans Any Safer. Stay tuned for more. President Biden's first Pentagon budget, released late last month, is staggering by any reasonable standard. At more than $750 billion for Defense Department and related work on nuclear weapons at the Department of Energy, it represents one of the highest levels of spending since the Second World War, far higher than the peaks of the Korean or Vietnam Wars or President Ronald Reagan's military buildup of 1980s. And roughly three times what China spends on its military. Developments of the past year and a half, an ongoing pandemic, and intensifying mega drought, white supremacy activities, and racial and economic injustice among them should have underscored that the greatest threats to American lives are anything but military in nature. But no matter, the Biden administration has decided to double down on military spending as the primary pillar of what still passes for American security policy. And don't be fooled by that striking Pentagon budget figure either. This year's funding request suggests that the total national security budget will come closer to a breathtaking $1.3 trillion. That mind-boggling figure underscores just how misguided Washington's current security, a word that should increasingly be put in quotation marks, policies really are. No less concerning was the new administration's decision to go full speed ahead on long-standing Pentagon plans to build a new generation of nuclear-armed bombers, submarines, and missiles, including, of course, new nuclear warheads to go with them, at a cost of at least $1.7 trillion over the next three decades. In all, Biden's first budget is a major win for key players in the nuclear industrial complex, like Northrop Grumman, the prime contractor on the new nuclear bomber and a new intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, General Dynamics, the maker of the new ballistic missile submarine, Lockheed Martin, which produces sea-launched ballistic missiles, SLBMs, and firms like Honeywell that oversee the key elements in the Department of Energy's nuclear warhead complex. The Pentagon's proposed base budget, which in the past year has included routine spending for fighting ongoing conflicts, was $715 billion for the fiscal year 2022, $10 billion more than last year's request. Despite complaints to the contrary by advocates of even higher Pentagon spending, that represents no small addition. It's larger, for instance, than the entire budget of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. No question about it, the Pentagon remains by a long shot the agency with the largest discretionary budget. As for what's in the base budget, there are a number of particularly troubling proposed expenditures that warrant attention and congressional pushback. Spending on the Pentagon's new intercontinental ballistic missile, known formally as the Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent, has nearly doubled in the new proposal from $1.4 billion to $2.6 billion. This may seem like small change in such a budget, but it's just a down payment on a system that could, in the end, cost more than $100 billion to procure and another $164 billion to operate over its lifetime. More importantly, as former Secretary of Defense William Perry noted, ICBMs are some of the most dangerous weapons in the world because a president would have only a matter of minutes to decide whether to launch them upon a warning of an attack, greatly increasing the risk of an accidental nuclear war based on a false alarm. In short, the new ICBM is not just costly, but exceedingly dangerous for the health of humanity. The Biden budget should have eliminated it, not provided more funding for it. Another eye-opener is the decision to spend more than $12 billion on the F-35 combat aircraft, a troubled, immensely expensive weapon system whose technical flaws suggest that it may never be fully ready for combat. Such knowledge should, of course, have resulted in a decision to at least pause production on the plane until testing is complete. House Armed Services Committee Chair Adam Smith has stated that he's tired of pouring money down the F-35 rat hole, while the Air Force's top officer, General Charles Brown, has compared it to a Ferrari that you don't drive to work every day, but only drive it out on Sundays. Consider that an embarrassing admission for a plane once publicized as a future low-cost bulwark for the U.S. combat aircraft fleet. Whether the Air Force, Navy, and Marines, the three services that utilize variants of F-35, will stay the course and buy more than 2,400 of these aircraft remains to be seen. Count on one thing, though. The F-35 lobby, including a special F-35 caucus in the House of Representatives, and the Machinist Union, whose workers build the planes, will fight tooth and nail to keep the program fully funded, regardless of whether or not it serves national security needs. And keep in mind that the F-35 is only one of the many legacies of failed Pentagon modernization efforts. Even if the Pentagon were to acquire its new systems without delays or cost overruns, something rare indeed, its expensive spending plans have already earned this decade the moniker of the terrible 20s. Worse yet, there is a distinct possibility that Congress will push that budget even higher in response to wish lists being circulated by each of the military services. Items on them that have yet to make it into the Biden Pentagon budget include things like, surprise, more F-35s. The Army's wish list even includes systems it claimed it needed to cut. That the services are even allowed to make such requests to Congress is symbolic of a breakdown in budgetary discipline of the highest order. The base budget also includes mandatory spending for items like military retirement. This year's request adds $12.8 billion to the Pentagon's tab. theoretically, that nearly $1.3 trillion to be spent on national security writ large is supposed to be devoted to activities that make America and the world a safer place. That's visibly not the case. When it comes to so many of the funds that will be expended in the name of national security, from taxpayer dollars thrown away on weapon systems that don't work, to those spent on an unnecessary and dangerous new generation of nuclear weapons, to continuing to reinforce and extend the historically unprecedented U.S. military presence on this planet by maintaining more than 800 overseas military bases around the world. Unfortunately, unlike the proposed Pentagon budget, significant Green New Deal-style infrastructure funding is far less likely to be passed by a bitterly divided Congress. Washington evidently doesn't care that such investments would also be significantly more effective job creators. Sadly, though, too many of America's political leaders have clearly drawn the wrong lessons from the pandemic. If this country continues to squander staggering sums on narrowly focused national security activities at a time when greatest challenges are anything but military nature, this country and the world will be a far less safe place in the future.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. Please accept our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about the Master of the Martyrs, Sayyid al-Shuhada, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Stay tuned. It is mentioned in the Ahadith or the narrations that if you are going to visit the holy shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and you shed tears upon visiting his tomb, your teardrops have roots in the divine permission that was given to you by Allah and the Ahlul Bayt. This means that your teardrops for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are the signs of your grief and sorrow in heart.
Karbala, as I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala, I see heaven has been beneath your skies.
May Allah bless the soul of the famous Persian poet Hafiz, who in his beautiful poem says,
Suze dil,
sorrow in heart,
ashke ravan,
teardrops,
ah sahar,
sigh at dawn,
nale shab,
and moan during night, or all the signs of your kindness, O my beloved one. We must ask Allah to give us the chance of sorrow, grief, and shedding tears for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, our beloved one, during the month of Muharram.
Karbala, why do you hold such memories? Ashura, always full of mysteries. Ashura, always full of mysteries.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
Beginning, the season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Our new year starts with morning. Muharram is a beginning. The season's tears are flowing. Our Imam, we are condoling. Karbala, what precious blood was spilled there. Ashura, Al-Hussein was murdered here. Ashura.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Birds that travel long distances can disperse seeds far and wide. An assessment of the timing and direction of the European bird migration reveals how these patterns might affect seed dispersal as the planet warms, says Barnabas H. Daru, researcher, in an article published under the heading Migratory Birds Aid Redistribution of Lands to New Climates. Stay tuned for more. B. the rapid pace of global warming and its effects on the habitats raise the question of whether species are able to keep up so that they remain in suitable living conditions. Some animals can move fast to adjust to a swiftly changing climate. Plants, being less mobile, rely on means such as seed dispersal by animals, wind or water, to move to new areas. But this redistribution typically occurs within 1 kilometer of the original plant. Writing in Nature, Gonzalez Varro et al. Shed light on the potential capacity of migratory birds to aid seed dispersal. When the climate in a plant's usual range becomes hotter than it can tolerate, it must colonize new cooler areas that might lie many kilometers away. It is not fully clear how plants distribute their seeds across great distances, let alone how they cross geographical barriers. One explanation for long-distance seed dispersal is through transport by migratory birds. Such birds ingest viable seeds when eating fruit and can move them tens or hundreds of kilometers outside the range of a plant species. In this mode of dispersal, the seeds pass through the bird's digestive tract unharmed and are deposited in feces, which provides fertilizer that aids plant growth. In the case of European migratory birds, for example, the direction of seed dispersal will depend on whether the timing of fruit production coincides with the bird's southward trip to warmer regions around the equator or northward to cooler regions. Many aspects of this process have been a mystery until now. Gonzalez Varro and colleagues report how plants might be able to keep pace with rapid climate change through the help of migrating birds. The authors analyze the fruiting times of plants, patterns of bird migration, and the interactions between fruit-eating birds and fleshly fruited plants across Europe. Plants with fleshy fruits were chosen for this study because most of their seed transport is by migratory birds, and because fleshy fruited plants are an important component of the woody plant community in Europe. The common approach until now has been to predict plant dispersal and colonization using models fitted to abiotic factors such as the current climate. Gonzalez Varro et al. Instead analyzed an impressive data set of 949 different seed dispersal interactions between bird and plant communities, together with data on entire fruiting times and migratory patterns of birds across Europe. The researchers also analyzed DNA traces from bird feces to identify the plants and birds responsible for the seed dispersal. The authors hypothesized that the direction of seed migration depends on how the plants interact with migratory birds, the frequency of these interactions, or the number of bird species that might transport seeds from each plant species. Gonzalez, Varro, and colleagues found that 86% of plant species studied might have seeds dispersed by birds during their southward trip towards drier and hotter equatorial regions in autumn, whereas only about one-third of the plant species might be dispersed by birds migrating north in spring. This dispersal trend was more pronounced in temperate plants than in Mediterranean plant communities examined. These results are in general agreement with well-known patterns of fruiting times and bird migrations. For example, the fruit of most fleshy-fruited plants in Europe ripens at a time that coincides with when birds migrate south towards the equator. Perhaps the most striking feature of these inferred seed movements is the observation that 35% of plant species across European communities, which are closely related under the evolutionary tree, might benefit from long-distance dispersal by the northward journey of migratory birds. This particular subset of plants tends to be fruit over a long period of time, or has fruits that persist over the winter. This means that the ability of plants to keep up with climate change could be shaped by their evolutionary history, implying that future plant communities in northern hemisphere will probably come from plant species that are closely related and that have migrated from the south. Or, to put it another way, the overwhelming majority of plant species that are dispersed south toward drier and hotter regions at the equator will probably be less able to keep pace with rapid climate change in their new locations than will the few winners that are instead dispersed north to cooler climates. To determine which birds might be responsible for the plant redistributions to cooler climates in the north, the authors categorize European bird migrants into Paleoarctic, those that fly to southern Europe and northern Africa during their non-breeding season, and Afro-Paleoarctic, those that winter in sub-Saharan Africa. Only a few common Paleoarctic migrants, such as the black cap, or Sylvia antricapilla, or blackbird Turdus merula, provide most of this crucial dispersal service northwards to cooler regions across Europe. Because migratory birds are able to relocate a small, non-random subset of plants, this could well have a strong influence on the types of plant community that will form under climate change conditions. A major problem, however, is that the role of these birds is dispersing seeds over long distances is already at risk from human pressures and environmental changes. Understanding these large-scale seed dispersal interaction offers a way for targeted conservation actions to protect the areas that are most vulnerable to climate change. And this could include boosting protection efforts in and around the wintering grounds of migratory birds, locations that are already experiencing a rise in human pressures such as illegal bird hunting. Gonzalez, Varro and colleagues' focus on seed dispersal across a northern hemisphere region means that, as with most ecological analysis, the results are dependent on scale, which can cause issues when interpreting data. Because the northern hemisphere has more land area and steeper seasonal temperature gradients than the southern hemisphere does, seed dispersal interactions might have different patterns from those occurring in southern hemisphere or in aquatic systems. For example, seed-eating birds from the genus Squally migrate from southern hemisphere to spend the dry season in equatorial West Africa, then move southwards again when the rains arrive. Their arrival in southern Africa usually coincides with the end of the wet season in this region, when annual grass seeds are in abundance. It will be worth investigating whether migratory birds in the southern hemisphere also influence the redistribution of plant communities during global warming. Likewise, Exploring the long distance dispersal of seeds of aquatic plants, such as seagrasses by waterbirds, is another area for future research that might benefit from Gonzalez-Varro and colleagues' methods. This study provides a great example of how migratory birds might assist plant redistribution to new locations that would normally be difficult for them to reach on their own and which might offer a suitable climate. As the planet warms, understanding how such biological mechanisms reorganize plant communities complements the information available from climate projection models, which offer predictions of future species distributions. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM. 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa maulana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another program of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. During the past few years, even in our current situation, with the coronavirus being around, it is very difficult for most of us, or many of us, to go for the ziyarah of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And it's also sometimes was impossible for us to go to the Husseiniyas or to go to the places where the mourning ceremonies of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was taking place. Obviously, over the past few years, internet and the concept of the virtual majalis became in fashion, but it is not the same. And that becomes clear when we see this tradition of Imam Baqir alayhi salam. For the Imam alayhi salam mentioned this tradition in connection with those who are unable to go for the ziyarah of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on the day of Ashura. And he mentions a particular manner of mourning that should be done in the place of residence and in the house of that particular person, or of the Shia in general, or any Muslim who is a lover of Imam Hussein alayhi salam can do this. So the Imam alayhi salam, that is Imam Baqir alayhi salam, says that that person who is not able to do or go to the plains of Karbala on the day of Ashura should mourn over Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and weep for him and instruct the members of his house to weep for him. He should establish the mourning ceremony in the house by exhibiting lamentations and grief over Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. This is an important lesson for us. That in the holy month of Muharram and in the days and nights of mourning, we should show that we are mourning. We should, you know, lament and show people that we are lamenting. So when people ask why you like this, you can tell them the story of why you are like this and the reason why that we are like this. Then Imam alayhi salam continues and says, the people should meet one another in their homes and offer condolences and consolation to each other over the calamities which befell Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So here the Imam alayhi salam is showing that the mourning gatherings, the majalis, regardless, should not stop. Even if a person just has to do it in his or her home with the family members, with the immediate family members, maybe even some extended family members, it should continue. The grief should continue. Because in essence, if Imam al-Zaman, ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-sharif, is grieving, then it is only, you know, necessary for those who claim to follow the Imam alayhi salam